Great. So this is probably a silly and redundant thing to say, but I'll say it anyway. Interrupt, ask questions.
Excuse me, I have a question about
okay. And the important questions are not necessarily if you have dumb, silly questions about nuclear matter or nuclear physics, those are the great questions to ask. So please don't interrupt. Don't be shy. So the nature of dense matter is in the title. The equation of state, pressure as a function of density, is not necessarily the end goal. We'd like to learn what the stuff is made of, what makes dense matter tick. I'm a nuclear physicist. So when I look up at the beautiful night sky, I see neutron-rich matter. You compress almost anything enough, electrons capture on protons to make neutron-rich matter. It's the heart of many fundamental questions in nuclear physics and astrophysics. What are the high-density phases of QCD? Where do the chemical elements come from? What's the structure of many compact and energetic objects? What determines their electromagnetic neutrino and gravitational wave radiations? We're interested in neutron-rich matter over a tremendous range of density and temperature. It can be a gas, a liquid, a solid, a plasma, a liquid crystal. The liquid crystal phases are my favorites. They're known as nuclear pasta. I've done a lot of work on that, but I won't talk so much about nuclear pasta here. It can be a superconductor, a superfluid. It's thought in the limit of extraordinarily high density. It's a color superconductor. So neutron-rich matter is a very versatile material. Yes?
First down question. All these states that you... So those are all known to exist, or there are possibilities?
So let's try a few. The solid, neutron star crust. I would claim we have evidence from crust cooling. A neutron star accretes for a while and then cools quickly, that there's a layer with a very high thermal conductivity, which is what we'd expect for a clean crystalline solid. So we have some evidence for the solid. Nuclei are liquid drops, so most of our evidence in nuclear matter involves liquids. A gas in a supernova, it's hot. The neutrinos are coming from what we believe is a warm gas of neutron-rich matter. We have some evidence for superfluid with neutron star glitches and the vortices that we believe are associated with those.
Now that you're talking about this, what is the status of strange quark matter and quark nuggets? Are those things still possibilities?
So we'll get to strange matter a little bit towards the end. We haven't seen any strange nuggets is the short answer. So there's a lot of negative evidence, but it's very difficult to 1,000% rule out strange matter hypothesis.
99% would be good.
Can you say briefly what a color superconductor is?
Sure. So asymptotic freedom. You go to very high density, you have quarks and gluons, which are weakly interacting. There are particular color, flavor and spin states of two quarks which have an attractive interaction when you exchange a gluon. So it's thought that at very high density, these nearly free quarks would pair up. And the pairing gaps could be very big. So like a normal superconductor, these are Cooper pairs of quarks. You don't carry electric current, but you carry color currents. So in a word, that's a color superconductor. Talk about it at the very end if I, in the event I get there. Okay, great. So lots of interesting phases. So what does neutron-rich matter look like to gravitational wave detectors? So we've talked about deformability. So I'll talk about deformability to begin with. I'll mention one laboratory experiment. So what does neutron-rich matter look like in the laboratory? I'll give you one example. Some really good questions to be asking are things like, what holds up a two solar mass neutron star? The pressure is high enough, clearly, but why? What's the physics? What's the nature of those interactions that give rise to that high pressure and high density that holds up the star? What are neutron stars made of? Could be quarks, could be strange quarks, could be neutrons and protons, could be hyperons. So that's a really good question. Sort of embarrassing, we don't know the answer. Most of the matter in a neutron star is at high density, and it's exactly in the region we don't know the phase.
Actually, Chuck, are you going to address at some point the question of what would make certain nuclear physicists give up their favorite composition? Because this often seems to be a sticking point, that no evidence is going to be sufficient for somebody to say, no, there's no quark.
So I won't give up anything, but I will talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'll talk about some evidence with the neutron star cooling and neutrino emission. Okay, great. So let's start with gravitational waves. You saw black holes in 2015, and then the difference when you saw neutron stars was the deformability, and I'll be confused. So gravitational deformability, tidal deformability, mass quadrupole polarizability, I will use those terms interchangeably, sorry. Okay, so here's the spectrogram. The frequency during the neutron star merger is rising because you radiate gravitational waves. But then right at the end, and Duncan talked about this much more rigorously, right at the end, you're not only losing energy to gravitational waves, but you're losing energy out of the orbital motion to the internal excitation of the two neutron stars, and that's the deformability. So the information on the deformability is right at the end, just before merger. So the tidal field of this guy is deforming that guy. So if you're a nuclear physicist, let's start with just the polarizability of an atom. If you start in the ground state, you have an electric field from the photon, for example, Y10 is a spherical harmonic, and you go to some excited state, some final state. So the numerator is scaling with the size of the system squared. The energy denominator for a Coulomb system like an atom scales with 1 over the size. You sum over all the final states. So you have R squared on top, 1 over R on the bottom. The polarizability of an atom, how an atom absorbs photons, depends on its size cubed, on the volume. So the radius of the atom cubed. Of course, the dipole just locates the center of mass for a gravitational system, so we're interested in the quadrupole polarizability. So R squared Y20, start in the ground state, so a spherical, if you like, neutron star, go to some excited state. The numerator is now R to the fourth. The energy denominator for a gravitational system goes like 1 over R. So this quadrupole polarizability, or deformability goes like the radius to the fifth power. So that's the quantity that the gravitational waves are extracting.
So I have a question sort of generally, especially for the GR knowledgeable types. How certain is it that we can actually parameterize the waveform deviations, which is what is actually being tried to be measured, by a single parameter lambda? And then as a follow-up, if the answer is that this can be done at 400 hertz, how certain is that we can do this to higher frequencies where contact is imminent? I mean, is this really clear that we can do just one parameter?
No.
Can we do it with this measurement? With one parameter?
So Kevin Bucket, who's a resident at Caltech, Moxie and I wrote a paper several years ago now where we basically looked at how accurately do we know the tidal deformability of the waveforms, either in the post-Newtonian, and we did a bunch of tests where we took one of Roland Hassett really accurate neutron star simulations, compared it to black hole with the PN term, without the PN term. We basically dissected it every which way. The short story is the errors in the numerical waveforms are comparable to the size of the effect you're trying to measure. There was a paper came out 4 weeks ago from BAM simulations to tune the tidal NR simulation, and the errors in those waveforms are comparable to Kevin's waveforms. So the phenomenological waveforms that are being tuned right now, the simulations being used to tune them, the error is comparable to the size of the tidal deformability. So we don't have high precision waveforms to calibrate, to say we are really, really measuring this. What we're measuring is the leading order post-Newtonian curve.
And that one you're confident in, right?
I mean, it's calculated well, but yeah, it's not.
Yeah, so if I could ask, there I think there's two parts to his question.
Right.
One is, do we have accurate enough waveforms now? And you're saying no. To get really precise deformabilities, we need better waveforms. And then the second question is, if you had really good waveforms, mm-hmm. is there more, or is this the first thing that would be extracted, mm-hmm. or is it more complicated?
Oh, well, Shomi has results that basically show that if 7817 happened at design sensitivity, you would get good tidal deformation measurements. But with 7817, you can only rule out the stiffest equations of state. You can't distinguish your black holes and neutron stars for 7817. So if your question is measurability of this effect in 7817, you cannot distinguish between a binary black hole waveform and a soft neutron star waveform with 7817.
But that's
still
leading order polarizability.
Right. Yeah, but I interpreted Chuck as...
I mean, we all agree the leading order term that's been extracted so far has a significant error.
Well, the other thing,
but it's still progress.
That's what we're saying. Like, if you look at the in spiral crack, you know, early on, those terms are irrelevant. As you start going up, these first two parameters become relevant, and then the very, very last bit where things become very non-uniform, there are probably many, many other parameters that are required to describe it, mm-hmm. other than these two leading ones before they smash together. And then, you know, then yeah. it's a completely different problem. And so, yeah, generically, yes, they are going. These are just the first leading order terms. They could have the strongest effect in the leading spiral, and then there'll be a little bit of a piece where other stuff happens. But I don't think people have a handle on that. So probably for quasi-circular in spirals, it's not. They're probably not that important.
So we do have another route besides the numerical simulations, and we do get comparable errors to tidal deformabilities. But there are also analytic models that incorporate higher order tidal contributions with two different methods. And that's what we use currently to estimate the systematics of these measurements. We compare the phenomenologically calibrated waveforms with waveforms coming from analytic expansions that expand in higher order tidal parameters with this linear effect, as well as F-mode resonances or other attempts to kind of wrangle through an expansion of the next most important corrections.
But it's an expansion that we don't know for sure if it converges. So.
Yeah.
Well, yes, but you can use pretty straightforward arguments to say these should be the next most important contributions and quantify how much they contribute. So that's what
is that could throw a wrench in the whole argument is this dynamical tides, because they actually do play a role.
They're in the waveform models we use.
Are they?
Yeah.
But they can,
one
there is an offset that is significant from early on.
Tanya calculated those.
Yes, so the one of the models we use, and we use these to quantify systematics incorporates the F mode resonances. If you're interested in something like the PG mode resonances in the early N spiral, those are also tested for. They don't actually.
I don't think they're interesting.
they don't actually affect this very much at all. It's just two different frequency ranges of how they come into the signal. Mm-hmm. So for this stuff, it's all high frequency information, as Duncan probably showed, and the routes we have to quantify waveform uncertainty come from phenomenological waveform models calibrated to numerical relativity, where there is no evidence that higher order parameters are required to describe them to current accuracies, as well as two families of analytic models that try and explicitly calculate higher order effects, including additional parameters that come from the equation of state information. Those additional parameters use sometimes universal relationships to relate them back to these fundamental parameters to within the accuracies currently established.
Great. So stay tuned as the data gets better.
Yeah, so for this signal and this noise, statistical errors are larger than our systematics, we're pretty sure. But in advanced LIGO design, it would be a totally different story. We would be clearly systematics limited with this signal.
And you're saying already in advanced LIGO design, by for this system.
Yeah. If this system happened at this point, the light would not be accurate enough. Just the statement is mm-hmm. the takeaway message.
I hope we have that problem.
It would be delightful to be systematics limited.
Yes.
Okay, great. So I'm going to come back quick in just a little bit and compare the information we have with some nuclear physics. So I wanted to say a little bit about one nuclear physics experiment to compare to. And so this is PREX. It's using parity violating electron scattering to accurately measure the neutron radius of lead, and I'll argue this has important implications for neutron-rich matter, astrophysics, and the equation of state. So let's compare two isotopes. So lead has 126 neutrons and 82 protons. It's got 44 extra neutrons. We think some of those extra neutrons go out in the surface. And we want to measure the thickness of this neutron skin, a little more on that in a second. And it's the pressure of neutron-rich matter that's pushing those neutrons out against surface tension. So if you measure a big skin, that's a high pressure for neutron-rich matter. Most of the lead nucleus is more or less symmetric matter with equal numbers of neutrons and protons. Symmetric matter is bound to the pressure at nuclear density is zero, so we want to learn about the neutron matter pressure, which is the important one for the neutron star. So we have to look in this surface region that's neutron rich. So I'll come back to that in a second. But just the idea is the pressure is holding it out against surface tension, so a big pressure gives a big radius. And that's exactly the same thing that's going on with the neutron star. A big pressure gives you a big radius, so you're holding the neutron star up against gravity, so if the radius is big, that's telling you the pressure of neutron matter is big in the neutron star.
So my question was then, I wonder if there are two particular differences between the lead 208 and the neutron star, which would have to be corrected for, and I'm curious about how well that correction should be made. One, as you mentioned, is surface tension effects, mm-hmm. which are not so important for the neutron star in bulk, but they are potentially for the lead. And the second is that lead 208 is a doubly magic nucleus, whereas you don't have probably the same filled shells with 10 to the 57 nuclei. So are those things which are A, potentially important, and B, understood well enough that the lab experiments can be properly interpreted?
So the first one, surface tension, is probably yes. We understand the surface tension very well because we can just look at the binding energy of nuclei as a function of size, as a function of their surface area.
Okay.
So surface tension we know. The closed shells are looked at exactly the opposite way. And we chose lead carefully to be closed shell because it has the simplest nuclear structure. We don't want, for example, one valence neutron and its properties dominating the skin or something like that. We're trying to get at this bulk property. So a number of calculations for non-closed shell nuclei suggest that the closed shell system is the simplest, and then its skin is more simply related to the bulk pressure.
Great, thank you.
So, neutron star is not quite to scale. A neutron star is 18 orders of magnitude larger, but it's the same neutrons, the same strong interactions, and the same equation of state. And I guess if you're keeping track, here's LIGO compared to a neutron star. I guess the Cosmic Explorer is only a little bigger than the page. So we're going to use parity violation, and there's never mind the details here. Why don't I just come to this? So this is a picture of lead. This is density versus radius, 8 Fermi-ish. The root mean square charge radius is 5.5 Fermi's for lead. The dashed red is the point proton density. So there are 82 protons in lead. The area under that's 82. The 126 neutrons is this black dashed line. And the idea is we're going to measure very carefully and very precisely how much the neutrons stick out compared to the protons. So that's this surface thickness. Okay. And the way we do it cleanly is with parity violation, although it's a very difficult measurement. And the idea in the standard model, the Z boson carries the weak neutral current. It couples to what's called the weak charge. The weak charge of a proton happens to be very small. The weak charge of a neutron is big. So the weak interactions at low momentum transfer are probing the neutrons. What we measure is a parity-violating asymmetry. So it's this fractional difference. If you have positive helicity electrons, so electrons spinning in the same direction as their motion. So that cross-section compared to the cross-section for negative helicity electrons. And this is the weak interactions. This difference is a part in a million. So that's why the experiment is hard. But if you can measure that cleanly, it's the interference, so it's a weak amplitude over an electromagnetic amplitude. The weak amplitude goes like G Fermi, the weak coupling constant. Weak form factor, this is the Fourier transform of the weak charge density, and the weak charge density is essentially the neutrons. So if we can measure this, we can, in principle, model independently map out the distribution of neutrons. And why this wasn't done long ago is because it's really hard. The parity violation is a part in a million, but if we can measure it cleanly, the interpretation is very clean. So this electroweak reaction is free from most strong interaction uncertainties. That's why we're working so hard. Okay, give me 2 seconds. These are just some words that nuclear physicists use, the symmetry energy. So the symmetry energy describes how the energy of nuclear matter rises as one goes away from equal numbers of neutrons and protons. So a nucleus is more or less symmetric, and then a neutron star is almost pure neutrons. So the symmetry energy allows extrapolation from laboratory systems with small neutron excesses to very neutron-rich astrophysical systems. If you put the 44 extra neutrons in lead in the center, that costs the symmetry energy at high densities. But if you put them in the surface, it only costs the symmetry energy at low density. So if the symmetry energy rises rapidly with density, that will push the extra neutrons from the interior out into the surface. So a big density-dependent dSd rho for the symmetry energy will inflate the neutron scan, give you a big neutron scan.
And is the origin of the excess symmetry energy at high density simply the Fermi level, or
so about half of it comes from just the Fermi levels that a pure neutron gas has a higher Fermi energy than neutron plus protons. The other half comes from the interactions. A neutron and proton have a more attractive interaction than two neutrons. Okay. You can also think of this dSd rho, sometimes called the symmetry pressure, and the pressure of symmetric nuclear matter is zero at saturation density. So this quantity is basically the pressure of neutron matter at normal nuclear density. So measuring the neutron skin gives you the pressure, gives you the equation of state. Okay, the experiment runs at Jefferson Lab. This is an electron accelerator in Virginia. Polarized electron source, a 1 GeV electron beam, comes into the hall. You scatter from a thick lead foil target that's been isotopically enriched in lead-208. And the scattered electrons are collected in two large high-resolution spectrometers. These electromagnetic spectrometers are about five stories high. So that's the detectors. We had a preliminary measurement in 2010. This parity violating asymmetry is 0.66 parts per million, about a 9% statistical error. And from that, I inferred the neutron radius minus the proton radius in lead is about 0.3 Fermis. And this error is dominated by the statistics.
Is that the offset you showed in the graph, you know, half a dozen slides back?
So it's basically. Okay. So the collaboration is working very hard right now. Installing two more experiments that will run. In the summer, we'll measure lead again to get higher statistics. Instead of 0.3 Fermis, the goal is, instead of these error bars, I want to reduce them by about a factor of three. And then we will also measure a lighter closed shell nucleus, calcium-48. So we are installing now. Lead runs in the summer, and then the fall and spring is when C-Rex will run. So basically, this exactly overlaps the third LIGO observing run.
Is this timeline still your best guess for?
This timeline is happening. Yes, it's still. Let's see. So actually, they're building stuff. Here's the septomagnet, and they're very busy putting all the equipment on the floor. Great. Let's see. I better say a little bit about chiral effective field theory. And the point I just want to emphasize is we don't know how to calculate the properties of dense matter, even in principle. That's important. So when somebody's quantum Monte Carlo says they've got great computers now and they can do the calculation much more accurately and they have control over the many-body approximations, etc., that's all true, but they don't know what their Hamiltonian is. They don't know what the interactions are. And this is why observations are so important. This is one area where we can't calculate even in principle.
So a question about that. What are the prospects of ever being able to calculate this from QCD?
Yeah, so I'll talk about chiral effective field theory, and you'll see that this won't get significantly better. Lattice QCD has this sign problem, so it can't calculate now. Whether it ever can calculate, maybe quantum computers can help, we don't know. So the sign problem in Lattice QCD for dense matter is a fundamental technical problem at the moment. So the answer to your question is, I don't know.
What does that mean, sign problem? Is that referring?
So you have an action in Lattice QCD, and if that action is real and positive, then you can interpret it as a probability, then it's easy to do Monte Carlo sampling. If you have a finite chemical potential, the present formulations for Lattice QCD give you a complex action. And that's really hard to Monte Carlo. And there's... So it's just a technical problem, but it's a really big and important and resistant technical problem.
Well, actually, so a question about that. Is it fundamentally hard because when you have something that's a non-trivial phase that oscillates a lot, it's tough to get the integral?
Yes. That may be related to fermions having lots of nodes in different places in the wave function.
So I mentioned this because one of the talks at Hartlefest on Friday was somebody who was talking about how he's got this new technique for doing integrals, which are highly oscillatory. And now whether this is something that could possibly be extrapolated to what you're doing, I don't know. But
There are several approaches not unlike that for dealing partially with the sign problem, and there are different sign problems for quantum many-body systems. And they help a little bit, but they don't solve the issue.
My understanding is Lattice QCD will maybe able to pin down the three nucleon force in the next 5 or 2. I mean, is that going to be sufficient to...
Yes, I mean, there are things you can get out of Lattice QCD. So let me say a little bit about chiral effective field theory and come back to your comment, which is correct. So chiral effective field theory expands the interactions and powers of some momentum transfer over a chiral scale. And at lowest order, the interaction between two nucleons is due to the exchange of a pion. So pions are the lightest meson with the longest range. And all the high momentum behavior is encoded in a contact term. So essentially a point interaction between two nucleons. And there's a contact term. The value of this coefficient is fit to data. So it's a phenomenological constant, and that you fit to reproduce scattering data. So at lowest order, it's simple. You only have this interaction between two nucleons. As you go to higher powers of Q over lambda, you get more loops, so more pion exchanges. You get more complicated contact terms, additional parameters. And then finally, at order Q over lambda cubed, you get this three-body force. So there's an important interaction between three neutrons that depends on the coordinates of all three of the neutrons. Turns out the coefficients here are not so bad. They can be taken from fits to two-body scattering data and from other empirical sources. So this three-body force is relatively simple, and the uncertainty so far is not huge. If you go one more order, this three-body force involves 100-plus diagrams, and the full thing is really ugly. So many chiral effective field theory calculations used a simple three-body force of order N2LO and then a two-body force fit to phase shifts of order N3LO, which is inconsistent but convenient for calculations. And people have gone higher. there is a four-body force that enters at N3LO, and it gets complicated at N4LO. And if you keep going, well, you have five-body forces and six-body forces and so on. If this chiral expansion converges, it's great. It's a great organizing principle, and it tells you what the interactions are. If it doesn't converge, you're lost, and that's the problem. So when it doesn't converge, you don't know what the interactions are. It's not a question of knowing what the two-nucleon force is, because the three-nucleon and the four-nucleon and the five-nucleon forces, in principle, at high density, could be just as big. So when it doesn't converge, you're lost. Okay, great. So here's one way I want to compare. This is the deformability, and for simplicity, I just plot the deformability of a 1.4 solar mass neutron star. So up on this axis, the original LIGO band is here, and then there's been a revised bound where, for example, if you use the same equation of state for both stars, then it's the bound is something like 600. So at the moment, the LIGO is saying that you're below this yellow dashed line. So that's the only allowed part of the figure. So at least I drew the original figure tall enough that I'm still on the figure. The blue dots are our calculations. These are energy functionals or skirm forces. So they're actually relativistic mean field energy functionals. The difference doesn't matter. You've got about 10 parameters, and you can fit them to a variety of properties of finite nuclei, and then you make predictions. And you can calculate the full equation of state from an energy functional. So given the equation of state, we can calculate the radius of a 1.4 solar mass neutron star. You calculate the deformability, but then we can also calculate the properties of finite nuclei. So the neutron skin thickness, the neutron radius minus the proton radius of lead, is up here on this axis. And so the lead measure, the P-REX original measurement, is about 0.3 Fermis with this significant statistical error bar. The P-REX 2 measurement that's starting now, we hope to, the goal is to significantly reduce the error bar. Okay, so a deformability of about 600 suggests a neutron star radius of less than 13 kilometers, and a neutron skin thickness of about 0.21 Fermis or less. So this region here is the overlap of P-REX and LIGO. So that's the suggested skin thickness. Now there's some model dependence. There's an assumption, and basically the assumption is no dramatic phase transition. This observable is at somewhat lower density than these two. So in general, a high pressure gives you a big skin and a big radius, but if you had a high pressure at low density and a not so high pressure at higher densities, then that would break the relationship. So I just want to emphasize that. So pressure is a function of density is equation of state. The low density observable from nuclear structure, and in particular the neutron skin, probing the equation of state near nuclear density. The neutron star radius or deformability probes the equation of state at about twice nuclear density. And then the high density observable is the maximum mass of a neutron star, or the fate of the merger remnant. And that's probing the equation of state at high densities. So you want to combine information at different densities. And if you get different answers, if the answer at low density seems to disagree with the answer at high density, that may be a strong signature of a phase transition in between, or some strong density dependence to the equation of state. Okay, and so this is one way to try to present a bunch of things. So mass versus radius, the deformability can be interpreted as a upper limit on the radius. So this is actually 13.7 kilometers, so that's the original LIGO data, and we could perhaps move it into 13 kilometers now. Andreas Bosson argued that if the radius of a 1.6 solar mass neutron star was too small, then you'd have prompt collapse. You wouldn't eject enough matter for the kilonova. So he had this lower limit for the neutron star radius. Of course, you observe two solar mass neutron stars, so any equation of state should get up to this region. Half solar mass neutron stars probably don't exist, and that's unfortunate. They're very interesting, fascinating objects. The central density is not so much above nuclear density. So actually, the pressure or the radius of a half solar mass neutron star is really strongly correlated with the neutron radius in lead, with what PREX measures. So the PREX, the first PREX measurement, I can put it here as a lower limit on the radius of a low mass neutron star. We can argue.
But again, that's assuming no phase transition, right?
Well, you could have a phase transition between here and here, right, for example.
Right.
And so that's why I put it here rather than trying to put it up at 1.4. Okay, and then you can argue if the maximum mass was above something like this dotted line, then the remnant would have lived too long, would have been a very bright millisecond magnetar radiating too much electromagnetic information. So an exact position we can argue on this line, but if the maximum mass is too big, then the kilonova could be too bright. So there's this relativistic mean field equation of state called NL3 that's very stiff. This guy is, if you like, doubly ruled out. So the radius 14 plus kilometers is too big, the deformability is too big, so it's ruled out that way. It also holds up 2.8 solar masses. So if GW170817 would have produced a stable remnant, if this had been the right equation of state, and that would be this, presumably this bright magnetar we don't see. Okay, great. So what we really would like to know is not what the equation of state is, but whether it's quarks or strange matter or hyperons. But let me ask first just what holds up a two solar mass neutron star. Of course, we see them. So it's telling you the equation of state has high enough pressure at high density to hold it up. So all soft equations of state are immediately ruled out. That's good. But it doesn't tell you the composition. It doesn't tell you the high pressure could be strongly interacting nucleons or strongly interacting quarks. So you have to look at something beyond just the equation of state. And one other observable or additional observable would have to do with neutron star cooling. So neutron stars cool by neutrino emission from the high-density interior. And so the cooling is sensitive to the properties of high-density matter. Okay, so this is one figure. It's the speed of sound, or the speed of sound squared. So the derivative of the pressure with respect to energy density of neutron-rich matter as a function of baryon density. Nuclear density is here, so this goes to high density. This is a figure due to Larry McLaren, and Larry is a theorist that has worked for a long time on relativistic heavy ion collisions and the quark gluon plasma at high temperature. He has this quarkionic model. I'm not so wild about his model, but I like this figure. So his figure shows a big bump for the equation of state. Equation of state, the speed of sound. Speed of sound goes above a third. And a third is an interesting number. If you have massless quarks or massless gluons, the speed of sound is a third. So at very, very high densities, asymptotic freedom says you have nearly free quarks, and then the equation of state or the speed of sound would be a third.
I guess I've heard there's an argument, as you show here, that not only does it have to eventually get to a third, but it has to get to a third from below.
That's right.
What is that argument?
Sure. So at high density, the gluon interactions are weak. So we can use perturbation theory to calculate those interactions. Mm-hmm. And there are some channels which are attractive. So the perturbative corrections are attractive. And that tells you that the speed of sound starts at a third, and when you correct it, actually, it will be a little bit below a third.
Okay.
So that's why this curve is coming from below. Okay, so asymptotic freedom tells you this limit, and the nuclear physics tells you what's happening down here. Around twice nuclear density, that's where the deformability is really sensitive to. And then the only other input to this figure is that we see two solar mass neutron stars. So Larry is saying that the existence of two solar mass neutron stars tells you there's a big bump in the speed of sound. The bump probably goes well above a third. And the location of the bump, it can't be too low in density or it would give you a really big deformability. And it can't be too high in density or the star would already have collapsed.
But relative to these curves, where does that bound from the existence of two solar mass neutron stars sit?
So I'm saying that the existence of a two solar mass neutron star tells us there has to be a big bump in the speed of sound.
Do they have to go all the way up to 0.9?
Or 0.5? No. It probably, it almost certainly goes above a third, but exactly how high and exactly how wide, there's still some model dependence.
0.3 or 0.4.
Why do you say if it goes to the right, then the star will collapse to the left?
Oh, if the pressure is not high enough at these densities, then the star will just collapse to be so dense that even though the equation of state is really stiff at high density, it's too late.
And you get that from meteor regulator, just from the Uber.
That's right. Yeah, so. Okay, so qualitatively, the two solar masses says there's a bump in this figure, but exactly how high the bump is and how wide.
What do these intersection points with the third correspond to?
Oh, a third is just the limit for massless quarks and gluons.
Right, but the, I understand going asymptotically to the right, but the intersection.
Oh, here and here, well, if it's above a third, it has to get below a third at very low density, and then it actually has to have some minimum in order to approach a third from below.
So it's the perturbative QCD that sets the approaching one third from below. We know that.
That's right. So this much is here. So you have to have at least two crossings.
How compact can these stars be if you're
you actually make the food for organic foodstuffs, then you're making very, very thin lines.
In principle, yes, because, I mean, the deformability so far is basically only an upper limit.
Sure.
And certainly, the only limit on is you can't make it too compact because then the two solar masses fall.
Well, actually, the question, the reason I'm asking the question is there's this controversy and eventually might get resolved that you couldn't really have a compaction that's higher than one third. So we have the Buchta limit that's much higher, but there are some arguments that for nonlinear arguments that you can say, well, one third is just a magic number in some sense. So I want to know, I want to use this approach that I do.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly seen equations of state which are otherwise reasonable at low density give you very compact maximum mass stars, and especially if you have a phase transition that makes the high mass star even more compact. So I guess if you come back to here, you can have equations of state. And if you have a phase transition, then this part of the curve could be over like this. And that'll give you more compact. Yeah, so far the only limits on compactness are arguments like this about prompt collapse and not having ejecting enough material. We see a relatively big pressure at low density, but our error bar for P-rex is still big, so let's see what that. Great.
So Chuck, if you go back to the and that's what, so P-rex 2 will push the lower end of the error bar on that plot, how much that way?
Well,
we should ask Paul.
that's right. Let's go. So, I mean, if it's right in here,
right.
Then basically it'll give you a central number near here and then little error bars. So,
okay.
So yeah, and it may rule out all these guys up there.
Actually, while you're on this, one of the things you cautioned us on is that as you have gone here, at the P-rex densities, which are going to be much less than the densities in, say, a 1.4 solar mass neutron star, there could be a phase transition somewhere. But even at the lower densities, is the interpretation still subject to some model dependence? Because even at that density, I would have guessed that the neutron versus proton content in a neutron star could be different from what it would be in the skin. So is there a confidence in being able to, if we somehow had a half solar mass neutron star, could we say, yep, absolutely, P-rex tells us this about it? Or is there still some link that has to be made?
Yeah, so I would say, yes, we're reasonably confident. If measuring this neutron skin allows us to extract the symmetry energy, and then we can use the symmetry energy to talk about a range of different neutron richnesses.
So it's the symmetry energy and the S and L, so also the derivative of the symmetry energy, both
yes.
Come from that?
That's right.
Okay.
So you have confidence in the theory to extrapolate from the neutron skin to half solar mass neutron stars, but it's the phase transition that could happen in the middle that causes it. So.
I guess maybe you should just comment, because on that, the point number two, where there is a lower bound of the radius of the neutron star, that has too many, lots of assumptions to assume, and they could be completely wrong.
So this value, 10.5 kilometers, could be completely wrong.
Yeah, but it could be 9, 6, whatever. I mean, I don't think we have that, the assumption that goes into that statement is
that's right. That's right. I think. Let me. Yeah. Okay. Actually, let me go here. The radius and the deformability seem to depend on the equation of state at about the same density. So statements about the radius are pretty closely related to statements of the deformability. So this upper limit of 13 kilometers, I would say that the assumptions for that are pretty mild.
Yeah, no, that's not mild.
Okay, great. Yeah, actually, I think we can skip that. That's and I just wanted to emphasize that the maximum mass of a neutron star and the fate of the remnant are really the very closely related. So we've had a bunch of talks about these different lifetimes for the remnant. And I just want to really emphasize that the lifetime of a small change in the total mass or the chirp mass of the system could give you a big change in the lifetime of the remnant and qualitatively different behavior for the electromagnetic counterpart. And that if you observe mergers with different masses, that has important implications for the equation of state. What are neutron stars made of? Okay, we know the pressure. So you observe two solar masses. You have a pressure at high density. That pressure could be strongly interacting neutrons or strongly interacting quarks. Rick and the LHC, when they do relativistic heavy ion collisions, find a strongly interacting quark gluon plasma at high temperatures. So we know matter at very high temperatures is nowhere near osmotically free, at least the matter we can produce in the lab today. It has very strong interactions. The quarks and gluons interact so strongly they can't move very far. And as a result, this has a very low shear viscosity for the system. And so it's not a perturbative quark gluon plasma. It's a strongly interacting quark gluon plasma. I believe that it's also very likely that cold dense QCD, in other words, high baryon density and low temperature, matter is also strongly interacting. We're very far, even at neutron star densities, from an asymptotically free quark gluon plasma. So the interactions are likely to be strong. They're not perturbative at neutron star densities, probably. And these strong interactions give you the high pressure and hold up a two solar mass neutron star. But are those strong interactions between quarks or strong interactions between nucleons? So we have this phase diagram, and I picked this figure because it looked kind of blurry. And I think you should take this, and that's really a good thing to make it look. Because there's lots of this is fiction. We have a crossover at high temperatures. There may be a critical point, and there's a lot of interest in relativistic heavy ion collisions searching for that critical point. And then down here, neutron stars. The Kohler superconductor is probably where you get to, but very, very high densities, irrelevantly high densities, probably. Okay, let me use one phrase. So quark-hydron duality, that actually has a particular meaning in electron nucleus scattering. So if you scatter an electron off a nucleus at intermediate momentum transfers, q squareds of one or two GeV squared, you can describe the cross-section as a sum over hadron resonances. The resonances are basically excited states of the nucleon. Or you can describe it as deep inelastic scattering from quarks and gluons. So the resonances give you a series of bumps for the different resonances. And if you sum over all these bumps, kind of average a little bit, you get to a good approximation the deep inelastic quark and gluon response. So you can describe the scattering in terms of hadrons or in terms of quarks. And if you like, this is nothing but center mass and relative coordinates. So if you had a quark and an anti-quark, you have the coordinates of the two guys. That's one description. Or you can use the center of mass of the two guys as the location of the hadron. And the relative coordinate, if you sum over a whole bunch of oscillator states, think of all the different resonances, then that's the internal, the relative coordinate. So hadrons summing over all the excited states of the hadrons, or just the quark and gluon degrees of freedom. So you may be able to describe similar equations of state in hadronic or quark degrees of freedom. I think that's really important. So Weinberg has this very often quoted statement where you can use any degrees of freedom you want to describe the system, but if you use the wrong ones, you'll be sorry. So the efficiency of quark versus hadron description of freedom may depend on the strength of correlations in dense matter. So if you have this dense medium, if the quarks are strongly correlated into tiny little triplets, then the hadronic description of baryons, neutrons, is very reasonable. But if the size of these guys is comparable to the spacings and the correlations are not so strong, then it's iffy. And you can just go either way. So I think that's where we are. So to try to tell what neutron stars are made of, we want some additional observables. I want to mention briefly the heat capacity and neutron star cooling. So a heat capacity is actually counting the number of degrees of freedom in a neutron star. And so I think conceptually this is an interesting thing to think about. And the way we've done this is to consider a low-mass X-ray binary. When the neutron star accretes, the accretion heats the system. So there's a delta Q, amount of heat you're bringing into your neutron star. So think a styrofoam bucket and a calorimeter. You bring in some heat, you measure the change in temperature, the heat over the temperature, the change in temperature, that's the heat capacity. So we're going to use an accretion episode to measure the heat capacity of a neutron star. So these are three systems, low-mass X-ray binaries, and the energy deposited into the core of the star in ergs from an accretion episode may last a year or so. And after the episode is over, this is the final core temperature. So what we really like to measure is delta Q over delta T. Unfortunately, we don't actually have delta T information, but at least we have information on the final temperature. And so the final temperature is an upper limit on delta T. So the heat capacity has to be bigger than delta Q over the final temperature. So a constant heat capacity is a diagonal line in this plot. And here are limits on the heat capacity. We have to be below that. If you have a 1.4 solar mass neutron star, for example, with the APR equation of state made of neutrons, protons, electrons, and muons, if all the neutrons and protons are unpaired, the heat capacity is big. It's down here. If the neutrons and protons pair off in a superfluid or a superconductor, then their heat capacity basically is very small. So some of these guys are definitely paired. So the real heat capacity, well, first of all, if they were all paired, then here's the heat capacity of just the electrons and muons. So this is a lower limit, and the real star is probably between this line and that line. And then our upper limits, lower limits on the heat capacity here, about a factor of 10 below what we expect for a normal neutron star.
So a question about this. The crust is thick. So you've got a lot of crust between where the matter is actually hitting and heating the star and where the core is. What is the strong argument that you can actually infer things about the core necessarily? Yeah.
So that's the part I skipped over. Okay. And the deep crustal heating is the important. Uh-huh. Most of the energy when you accrete is just radiated in X-rays from the surface.
Yeah.
The 200 MeV per nucleon falling into a neutron star, most of that is just immediately radiated away. But you build up matter, and so matter sinks lower and lower in the accreted star. And as it gets deeper and deeper, it undergoes electron capture and peak no nuclear fusion reactions. And there's a lot of discussion on these deep crustal heating. These reactions are thought to inject an MeV or more per nucleon of heat. And the important thing is it's deep in the crust. And so that heat goes into the core rather than coming out in the surface.
So I guess, I mean, to follow up a little bit on that, the depth at which these reactions happen are an integrated amount of accretion that is a whole lot more than a single year of activity. It's something which can last for, I mean, thousands of years. It can take a really long time for the matter to get that deep. So wouldn't there be kind of a time-averaged rate of release? And if so, how is it that measurements of individual, even year-long accretion episodes can be confidently interpreted in the sense you're describing?
So one way to think about it is the nucleus is just sitting in the crust. It may have taken 10,000 years to get buried to some place.
Yeah.
But then when more matter accretes, the nucleus down here will cross one of these thresholds and undergo a reaction. And if you know how much matter comes in at the top, then that tells you how much matter is crossing the threshold down there. Okay. But you're right. The assumption is that this is in some steady state. And I'll have a little bit more to say on that in a second. Okay, and why this might be interesting is color superconductors. So if most of the star was a color superconductor where the negative charge is actually carried on the down and strange quarks, so the most extreme color superconductor doesn't even have electrons and muons. So it's just up, down, and strange quarks. So not only are there no leptons, but the quarks are paired, and there's a big pairing, so that the gluon exchange pairs these quarks. So the quarks are superfluid, so the heat capacity is very low. So all the degrees of freedom, you only have quarks, and they're all paired up. So the heat capacity of an extreme color superconductor is predicted to be very low, and this heat capacity limit we set rules out the most extreme color superconductor. Okay. So the last thing I wanted to say is a couple words on neutron star cooling, and I'll be done. And this is interesting and relevant because you cool by neutrino emission from the high density interior. So neutron star cooling is telling you something about the dense matter, the part that you're most interested in. Okay. Most neutron stars are consistent with normal cooling. And in normal cooling, correlated two neutrons undergo a beta decay. A neutron turns into a proton, electron, and an antineutrino. This antineutrino has energy of order kT and escapes the star. And then in a little while, the electron captures on the proton, giving you back the two neutrons you started with and a neutrino. This neutrino also has energy kT. So the net result is you radiate a neutrino antineutrino pair, and the star cools, and you the neutrons you started with stay there. In normal cooling, you need the second neutron to conserve momentum and energy in this beta decay. And if you need that second neutron, the phase space is so restricted that the rate of this process is relatively slow, and that leads to normal cooling for the star. If you can have a single hadron that's allowed to undergo beta decay, for example, if a neutron can just beta decay on its own, then you have enhanced cooling, and the star cools much faster. And that enhanced cooling requires you to conserve momentum and energy, and in particular, you need the Fermi momentum of the proton to be at least half the Fermi momentum of the neutron, so that since the Fermi momentum of the proton and electron are the same, that these two can add up to the big neutron Fermi momentum. Okay, and that's called direct ERCA, and if this is allowed, then the star cools very quickly. Okay, so I said most neutron stars are consistent with normal cooling. What I did want to point out is one particular low-mass X-ray binary. This star now has very good evidence that it needs enhanced cooling. So this is the first star with a well-measured surface temperature that strongly appears to need enhanced cooling.
So is that evidence for a large proton fraction?
Evidence for a large proton fraction or some other hadron, like a meson, a hyperon, or quarks that can beta decay. So it's evidence for enhanced cooling. And the evidence is right here. 50 eV is a relatively low temperature. And so what's plotted, this star accretes for a while, less than a year, and then it's quiescent for 15 years, and that's set by the accretion disk. And then it accretes again, and it's quiescent, and it accretes again, and it's quiescent. So we actually have observations over the last three outbursts for this star. So this star has observed three outbursts that are about the same duration and about the same distance apart.
So the data that you're showing are only for one of the three?
That's right, because this data, we don't have this detailed temperature. What we have is like an all-sky monitor, a less sensitive instrument. But when it's accreting, it's really bright, so it can see the really bright accretion, but we haven't measured the crust cooling in the past episode.
Yeah. Now, you show actual measured points for the effective temperature, and I understand where they come from.
Uh-huh.
You don't show measured points for the core temperature. Could you elaborate on
that? Oh, you just stick a thermometer in.
In there. Do you have any way of testing those curves?
Yes. So this is modeling, and you're completely right. There's some dependence on the envelope composition. But this 50 eV temperature is really low. That's the take-home message. And that even when you consider a lot of the modeling uncertainty, it's hard to make this central temperature very, very much bigger.
Okay, so what you're really saying is that the central temperature is a derived quantity from the effective temperature.
Yes.
So if this star did not have this enhanced cooling, kind of a similar picture of what would it look like?
Yeah, so it would quickly come into equilibrium, but it would have to have a much higher temperature in between, because The core would be much hotter in order to radiate enough neutrinos. So when it comes into equilibrium, neutrino radiation from the core over 15 years equals the amount of heat you get in one outburst. So this is the best case. for enhanced cooling. And so what we're left with right now is that a few stars need enhanced cooling, most don't. Presumably the stars that do are very massive, but we don't have independent mass information. And so we need some beta decay mechanism that kicks in, such as direct ERCA at high densities. And that mechanism can't kick in at too low a density, or most stars would have enhanced cooling. Okay, and that's where I am. So Farouk Fatoyev is a former postdoc that related the deformability for LIGO to the neutron skin in lead. So I wanted to mention his name. Thanks.
I have a practical question. So when I'm at Thanksgiving dinner with my relatives, and they ask me, what are the practical applications of what you do, can I say that we'll learn something about nuclear physics from this that actually has terrestrial applications? What is something about these isotopes of lead, et cetera, et cetera?
So we just learned where the galaxy makes all its gold.
I heard that in Astronomy on Tap last week. It must be true.
Even if it wasn't challenged. So Bob Rutledge is an X-ray astronomer at McGill, and he asks, you're measuring the equation of state. Now how do I make money off of that?
It's a serious question. Instead of saying, oh, it's unpredictable what we'll learn and the technological, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, it's a philosophical question. What's the nature of stuff? What makes matter matter? What's the extreme limit? How strong can it be before it all collapses into a black hole? We want to find out what extreme matter is really made of.
Another way of asking questions is, if you learn more about the equation of state, what other questions can you answer, or are you just done and you go on to do other things?
Well, we're trying to understand QCD because this governs the behavior of most of the matter in the universe, or most of the visible matter, excuse me.
Will it help you understand supernovae?
Yes. So the equation of state, the way neutrinos interact with this matter, the correlations in the matter, are certainly relevant for supernovae.
And I also had another question, which is, a soundbite you often hear is that if you reach a density where you get exotic matter, this makes the radius smaller and makes the maximum mass lower as well. Is that a generally true statement, or true with exceptions, or how should we take that?
So, a great big first order phase transition could have softened the equation of state a lot. Mm-hmm. But because we see two solar mass neutron stars, we know that doesn't happen. What you can't rule out is small first order phase transitions that only soften the equation of state a little bit.
To the provocative side of things, you just mentioned, because you said we just learned where all the gold and the high elements are produced. So do you have any comment on these kind of challenges as to the high mass elements not being produced when lining the stars, but suppose to an extent like collapse or something?
So the chemical evolution argument. Let me step back. I'm a nuclear physicist. The part I can comment on is how it depends on nuclear physics uncertainties. And an interesting uncertainty is the heating rate. So kilonovas, and that depends on nuclear physics. And the most uncertain nuclear physics is associated with fission. what we hope to do with EFRIN is measure the masses and beta decay half-lives of a lot of neutron-rich nuclei involved in the arc process. So once we measure those, we'll be able to make better predictions for abundance patterns. And when we have those, we may be able to constrain the conditions in the arc process better. So it's indirect, but it's the best we can do from nuclear physics. And whether that solves the astrophysical problem or not, we'll have to see. But EFRIM will turn on in 2021. It's being constructed now. And that and other radioactive beam facilities will be measuring a lot of our process nuclei soon.
Let's then jump in.